This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wahib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight, the UN mission in Mali officially ended a 10-year deployment in the country today, and fighting between Israel and Hamas intensifies across Gaza today. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Delegates at COP28, a UN climate conference in Dubai, have approved a fund to assist developing nations in dealing with the damaging effects of climate change. It is targeted for countries, particularly in Africa, that are disproportionately affected by climate-related disasters such as floods, droughts, and rising sea levels. VOA's Paul Ndiho spoke with Frank Tumusima, an environmental analyst and founder of Advocates for Natural Resources and Development, based in Uganda, who weighs in on COP28 and discusses the situation in his country, which is at a critical juncture on oil exploration.
It's part of the process of mitigation and adaptation to climate change, because the COP28 in itself is not an end to solving climate change. Yes, the key theme was setting up a fund to help decarbonize, especially with the global south, in most cases, the least emitters, because I think Africa emits about 3% of global greenhouse gas emissions. And then we know that petroleum, oil, gas, and mining, the extractive sector, contribute 1% of the greenhouse gas emissions. So Africa is way not there at all.
Lately, for example, we've had floods that have killed a lot of people from Somalia to Kenya to Uganda and most recently Tanzania. A couple months ago, we saw hundreds of thousands of people die in Libya because of these floods, and partly attributed to climate change. What do you think needs to be done to make sure that some of this funding that was agreed upon help Africans maybe tackle some of these problems?
First of all, there are some structural challenges within our system and society. You see, the first question is debt management and also avoiding bureaucracy. In simple terms, is that decision making in such big monies is key. And red tape kills decision making. And so there's a push from people who have given money, the development partners, but decisions are not being made, and money is not going down to benefit whom it's supposed to benefit.
Uganda is now, I guess, on the cutting edge of producing oil. You talked about how there's been an environmental impact. They have a need here where they want to basically maybe build this oil and petroleum industry so that they can create jobs for their own people. But at the same time, they're dealing with a lot of challenges when it comes to environmental protection.
Africa has about 40% of the global oil, gas, and mining resources that are not yet explored. Africa has just started, so that there's this argument that, look, let's first carbonize just like you did, then we shall decarbonize. And so that's why you see we have a refinery process taking shape. We have the East African crude oil pipeline taking shape, in order to prepare and first up the revenues. Then from there, it is assumed that there will be clean technologies in the oil extraction, refining, and transportation process. Then the money, some of it will be used to support the clean energy transition. However, as we said, the danger is the fossil fuel industry contributes big time, 70%. The greenhouse gas emissions. So it is a rather sustainable development. Can we conserve? Can we have oil out of the ground, extract, transport it sustainably? Is that possible? Well, when you look at the energy transition plan that has been Uganda has launched, this commitment to exploit our oil resources in a sustainable way.
That was Frank Tumusiimi, a senior researcher at Advocates for Natural and Development in Uganda, speaking with VOA's Paul Indiho. The UN mission in Mali says it officially ended a 10-year deployment in the country today, finishing a pullout ordered by Mali's military leaders. The mission, known as MINUSMA, lowered the United Nations flag on its headquarters in the capital, Bamako. A spokesman for MINUSMA said the symbolic ceremony marks the official end of the mission, she said, even though some of its elements are still there. The French news agency AFP says a liquidation phase will take place after January 1st, involving activities such as handing over remaining equipment to the authorities. West African leaders are maintaining sanctions imposed on Niger after a July military coup, demanding progress towards a short transition to civilian rule before easing the measures. Leaders of ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, met for a summit yesterday after coups in Mali, Burkina Faso, Guinea, and Niger since 2020 and two attempted coups elsewhere in recent weeks. According to the French news agency AFP, ECOWAS Commission President Omar Touré said heads of state group from Benin, Togo, and Sierra Leone would engage with Niger's military leadership and decide on other conditions for lifting sanctions. Egypt held the second day of voting in its presidential election today. Voting in the three-day election ends tomorrow. The election is widely expected to hand President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi a third term in power as the country grapples with an economic crisis and a war on its border with Gaza. Reporter Angie Omar in Cairo spoke to Egyptian voters on the first day to see how the process had been going. Amani Mohammed is among those who voted. She says there was some lack of organization and randomness outside the polling stations. Some people were directing others to vote for their candidates, but overall, things were fine. Laila El Said also says the process went smoothly. She says the polling station was calm from the inside and no one directed her or saw the candidates she voted for. However, outside the polling stations, there are people urging others to vote for Sisi. She says the quicks were not crowded and there were no problems in front of the polling stations. Things were generally peaceful. Hossam El Alafi says the polling stations were very organized. However, he says there was some randomness outside the polling stations and there were people repeating the names of the candidates, but inside the polling stations, things were calm. The results of the election are expected to be released on December 18th. President al-Sisi, three other candidates, Farid Zahran, head of the opposition Social Democratic Party, Abdul Sand Yamama, chairman of the Waft Party, and Hazim Omar, head of the Republican People's Party. None of them are considered to be high-profile candidates. Another presidential hopeful, Ahmed Al-Tantawi, dropped out of the race after he failed to secure the required signatures from residents to secure his candidacy. He blamed his failure on what he said was harassment by security agencies of his campaign, staff, and supporters. Campaigning for December 20th general elections is in full swing in the Democratic Republic of Congo in Goma. In the east of the country, some candidates claim to be victims of sabotage and aggression. The campaign had been marred by some violent incidents and campaign posters have been torn down. More from Zanim Neti Zaidi in Goma.
Silvana Muninga, a candidate for the National Assembly, claims to have been the victim of two attacks since the start of his election campaign. He has had difficulty carrying out his activities and lives in fear. He says as he was returning home from campaigning, when a group of people confronted him at the entrance to his home late at night, called him by name and his ballot number 22 and attacked him, taking everything. He is very worried and does not feel safe. His case is far from isolated. Candidates of all stripes claim to be victims of sabotage of their posters or physical aggression. Roger Binzika is a member of Congolese minister Mbusa Nyamwisi's RCD-KML party. He says he had put a sign on the footbridge at the Goma Institute, but it was rapid off. The person who had put it up was there in the morning, but one day later it was gone. It is almost the same thing in the various districts, so much so that his team wonders if there are not people trying to sabotage them.
Des gens qui voulaient nous saboter.
The group Action for Development, Civic Education and the Defense of Human Rights in the DRC says that the law is strict regarding the violation of candidates' rights during election campaigns. Karpat Tulinabo, a member of the group, calls on all candidates to respect the electoral law. He says all those who tear down candidates' posters, all those who commit violations or abuses during the campaign periods, must know that the law applies to them, because there must not be serious violations during the campaign periods. Whether it is those in power or in the opposition, everyone must respect the law. All campaigns must adhere to the norms and principle of electoral law. The Independent National Election Commission says it is determined to organize the vote on the 20th in accordance with the electoral calendar, even though it is reporting problems deploying electoral materials throughout the country. For VOA Africa, I'm Zane Mneti Zaidi in Goma.
You're listening to African News Tonight on the Voice of America. IGAD Executive Secretary Warkaneh Gabayo announced Saturday that Sudan's Sovereign Council Chairman Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and Rapid Support Forces RSF leader Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo have agreed to sign a cessation of hostilities agreement. The assembly also proposed a face-to-face meeting between Burhan, and who is also the army chief, and Dagalo, as well as the appointment of an envoy to Sudan. VOA's Nabil Biagio spoke with Salman Mohamed Salman, a Sudanese political analyst and chairman of the University of Khartoum Council, who says the shift from Jeddah negotiations to end Sudan's eight-month-long conflict to the region is important.
I would be inclined to be a bit cautious, because since the communique of the IGAD countries have come out, there have been further developments. As we speak, you know, in the past few hours, and I'm waiting for confirmation development. But if this was confirmed, it means that Sudan is trying to wiggle free from the commitment that General Burhan has taken, and this would be a very odd situation.
What exactly do you think the developments are? Because according to this announcement, both sides are willing to sign a cessation of hostilities agreement.
This is indeed the case. Now, this is the official outcome of the meeting of the IGAD. However, 24 hours later, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Sudan issued a statement saying that the communique of the IGAD did not reflect the resolution reached in the Assembly of Head of State correctly, and therefore they were warning that the communique need to be corrected, or otherwise Sudan would not be bound by the agreement.
What do you think the Sudan Ministry of Foreign Affairs could be referring to? According to this article, Al-Burhan had emphasized that any political settlement must involve the evacuation of civilian facilities and homes. Is that what they are talking about?
In front of his peers, Lieutenant General Burhan committed to agree to an unconditional ceasefire a meeting, one-to-one with Lieutenant General Hemeti, the head of the Republic of Forces, for reaching a ceasefire unconditionally, while the statement from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs puts all the conditions that have led to the failure of previous attempts for ceasefires, which is the evacuation of capital by the Republic of Forces and other conditions that are basically indicating that there is no political will on the side of those who are speaking on behalf of Sudan to end this war. And by that, I am referring to the factions of the Islamist movement who are fighting along the Sudanese army. Imagine, James, that President Biden goes to a summit in Asia and signs an agreement with President Xi of China, and before his return to the homeland, then the Secretary of the State Department issued a statement saying that agreement reached with China binding, according to the foreign ministry. This is exactly what happened.
It doesn't seem to me you are optimistic a peaceful deal can come out of the IGAD summit.
Well, this is, as I said, these are events that are happening in rapid succession. It has been, a moment in which we believe the IGAD meeting was a real breakthrough in the negotiations for a cessation of hostilities and humanitarian access and possibly a permanent ceasefire. However, the statement from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs basically is putting all this in question. So we'll need to see if Burhan is going to, honor the commitments he gave before his peers, or is he going to, follow the instructions that are outlined in the statement from the foreign ministries.
That was Salman Mohammed Salman, a Sudanese political analyst and chairman of the University of Khartoum Council, speaking with VOA's Nabil Biagio. Zimbabwe's ruling party won 7 parliament seats, contested this weekend by by-elections. The by-elections were held after 9 opposition members were recalled in internal party disputes just 3 months after national elections. Critics say the recalls were part of a power consolidation by President Emmerson Mnangagwa's ruling ZANU-PF party. Reporter Kusai Zanawashi in Harare has the details.
The by-election Saturday handed Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF 7 out of 9 contested seats. On the eve of the elections, a court ruling barred all Citizens Coalition for Change candidates who had been recalled from seeking re-election. They were recalled in a move by Sengenzo Chabang, who claims to be the party's secretary general, which the party leadership denies. Promise Mkwananzi is the spokesperson of the Citizens Coalition for Change. He says the ouster of the CCC candidates was done to aid President Emmerson Mnangagwa's ZANU-PF party. Mkwananzi links the recall of the parliament members to the ruling party's efforts to have 2/3 majority needed to amend the constitution. He alleges that ZANU-PF worked with Chabangu and the courts to oust the CCC members.
This is just something cooked up to ensure that Mnangagwa attains 2/3 majority. God knows what he wants to do with that 2/3 majority, but it is certainly not good for our country.
Farai Marapira is the director of information for ZANU-PF. He dismissed allegations that the party colluded to oust the 9 candidates, saying CCC members can pass as fiction writers. He blamed opposition infighting and political grandstanding within its ranks for the loss in the elections. Some government critics are concerned ZANU-PF wants to push through the constitutional amendments to allow Mnangagwa to run for re-election when his second term expires. Rashid Mukundu, a political analyst, says the main opposition faces being marginalized.
This is no longer a question of CC trying to be influential in parliament. The question is, what is it that they will change in parliament, working with the ruling party and government that has captured the judiciary, that has captured the security sector, or that has captured the parliament itself? The zone of struggle has significantly shifted. It's unstrategic to continue wanting to be in parliament and councils when you cannot do anything.
Mukundu says the main opposition should engage civic society, churches, and student movements to map a way forward. Also, a Zimbabwe court on Monday overturned a conviction inciting violence against an opposition activist who has already served 8 months of a 4-year jail term. Jacob Ngarivume's case drew attention to the detention of opposition figures before nationwide elections in August, when President Mnangagwa won a second term. Ngarivume, an anti-corruption activist, was jailed for 4 years in May on allegations of inciting protests against the ruling ZANU-PF party in 2020 on the Twitter platform now known as X. The Transform Zimbabwe party president said the post was put up by a ghost account. A Harare magistrate rejected that defense, but the High Court set aside the conviction, ruling that there was no evidence. For VOA Africa, this is Kudze Zvinavashe in Harare, Zimbabwe.
Fighting between Israeli and Hamas intensified across Gaza today, fueling fears of a mass exodus of Palestinians into Egypt. VOA's Esther Gitu-Etwart spoke to Dana El-Kord, a Palestinian-American senior non-resident fellow at the Arab Center in Washington, and began by asking her reaction to UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres' concern about the possible complete breakdown of public order.
Yeah, I think that Secretary Antonio Guterres, the reason he is taking this step is because of the ongoing inaction, particularly by Israel's allies, and them providing cover for what's happening. And just the scope of the destruction and devastation we're seeing in Gaza, I think, necessitates a larger reaction. My understanding of, you know, given the Security Council and how the UN functions, my understanding is that this may not change much in terms of UN policy or decisions, but it could muster a significant amount of aid and start particular mechanisms around that. And so, it's definitely maybe a little too late, in fact, for this declaration.
And now the United States is also calling on Israel to limit civilian deaths and displacement, saying too many Palestinians have been killed when it pounded much of Gaza City and also the northern part of Gaza. Is it possible to identify who is a civilian and place them in designated safe zones, or are there other options to keep civilians safe?
Really, the only option to keep civilians safe is for there to be a ceasefire and to begin political negotiations around hostages, around all the other issues that have spurred this latest escalation of violence. The fact of the matter is, this is a militant group, right, that is embedded in a civilian population. And there's lots of reporting to suggest by 972 Mag and others that it doesn't seem that the Israeli side necessarily cares about minimizing civilian deaths and civilian casualties. The point, it seems, given this investigation that I'm citing, it seems to just be about generating the greatest number of targets. So even if they're targeting someone who is not that important, the scope of civilian deaths is really tangential to that decision. So as you mentioned, there's been close to 20,000, maybe even more, Palestinians have been killed in the last 2 months, and over 80% of the entire population of the Gaza Strip has been displaced. And even when Palestinians are told to go into particular safe zones, those safe zones are again bombed. So there's really not a way to minimize civilian death given the method of warfare that Israel is undertaking, including, as I said, generating this great amount of targets using AI, using these new technologies, without a political negotiation. So that's where we need to go.
That was Dana El-Kord, a Palestinian-American senior non-resident fellow at the Arab Center in Washington, speaking with VOA's Esther Gitwe-Ewart. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.